the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow delegates, I'd like, if possible, to get this session underway. My name is Stephen Lewis. I'm an envoy on AIDS in Africa, and I am delighted to be participating in this session as the moderator. It's almost a celestial benefaction not to have to make a speech. This is a tremendously important satellite session, as these numbers demonstrate, dealing with the interrelationship between food and food security and nutrition and HIV, and above all, the relationship with gender. And we have a first-rate and highly distinguished panel to set out the dimensions of the subject matter. And they're all intending to speak for roughly 10 minutes, and I intend to be a perverse and draconian moderator and hold them to that time, because I've been at far too many sessions where there hasn't been enough time for the audience to ask questions and to make comment, and that seems to me to be an important ingredient of these discussions. So you will find me entirely unlovely in my behavior with the panelists. The first speaker, to provide a sense of context, is Stuart Gillespie, who's the Senior Research Fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute and co-founder and director of Renewal, and the author of a book which deals with these subject matters. And Stuart can begin and give you the context within which the discussion will take place. Stuart.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I'm going to speak only for 10 minutes, and I've got three parts to that presentation. The first is to provide some basic conceptual maps for navigating this interaction between HIV and AIDS and food and nutrition insecurity. The second part, to give the kind of broad headlines, the broad brush evidence for these interactions. And then the final section will be looking at tools and ways in which we can translate this evidence that we now have into effective action. So this is really what we're talking about. It's the interaction on the right-hand side, the conventional understanding of the direction of interaction between HIV/AIDS precipitating or exacerbating food insecurity or malnutrition. We're also learning a lot more about the left-hand arrow, the upward arrow, the ways in which people who are poor or food insecure, malnourished, are much greater risk of being exposed to the virus and being infected with it. And within this vicious cycle or downward spiral, we're learning more and more about the driver of gender inequity. A lot of discussion has been on the issue of feminization of the epidemic, but it's important to see how the feminization occurs on the left side of this diagram in terms of risk. Women are socially, culturally, economically, politically more likely to be exposed to the virus and biologically more likely to be infected with it. And on the right-hand side, the ways in which women are shouldering the extra burdens on top of everything else of HIV and AIDS. This is far too complicated to read all the words. The only point about this diagram is to illustrate the diversity and complexity of what we're dealing with. This is the big picture. 150 years ago, Louis Pasteur said, the microbe is nothing, the terrain is everything. This is the terrain, the universe of interactions. All I'm going to point out is if we look at the top half of this diagram, looking at the top left, we see the levels and types of driving forces, driving the epidemic, driving risk. At the epicenter, we see HIV infection. At the top right of the diagram, we see the waves and levels of impact. What we're trying to do is the bottom half of this diagram, the blue half. We're trying on the left-hand side to strengthen resistance to the virus at various levels, going from macro right down to microbiological levels. And at the bottom right, we're looking at ways of strengthening resilience, again, from the micro to the macro. Another map, this is at the household level or community level. Levels and types of susceptibility will determine whether HIV comes into that household or community at high rates. The downstream impacts of AIDS will be determined by the vulnerability of the livelihood system, and that is mediated by effects on assets, human, financial, social, natural, physical, political, by effects on institutions at different levels, right the way from community level up to global, leading in turn to various responses. This is where often people talk about coping. Coping is often just simply an external value judgment that doesn't match reality, and what looks like coping now in the future may clearly turn out to have a huge cost. Children being pulled out of school, for one example. Leading in turn to various outcomes. We are here talking about nutrition and food security, but fundamentally this is entwined again with the issues of relating to gender, specific vulnerable groups, and stigma and discrimination being itself an outcome. But the important point again is to realize that these outcomes are also inputs. They're inputs, they iterate back into, in a negative sense, worsening susceptibility or vulnerability, or if we turn it into a positive, to reduce risk and to reduce impacts. The final map is at the level of what's happening within the human body, the interaction and the vicious cycle between malnutrition and HIV. In 1968, Nevin Scrimshaw coined the term NAIDS to apply to the malnutrition infection complex that we were beginning to learn about back then. NAIDS is nutritionally acquired immune deficiency syndrome. We've known about this interaction. What HIV is doing is accelerating this cycle, and there are various specific HIV-specific interactions which are making it far, far worse. Okay, the second part now, quickly to show what we know about the evidence and looking at the upstream dimension. And I left some books and handouts. The book has just come out last week, AIDS, Poverty and Hunger, which Stephen mentioned, which captures some of the highlights of this evidence. This is the wrong slide. It shouldn't be in there, so I'll move on. Food insecurity leading to HIV exposure. We know that people who are at greater risk, who are poor, are more likely to have to be split up, to move around to look for work. We know that food insecurity exacerbates gender inequality itself, which, as we know, is a driver of the epidemic. AIDS is an occupational hazard within communities. Example, in Malawi, shifting livelihoods, women more and more being forced to undertake risky, casual, piecemeal work, and transactional sex being often built into those unwritten contracts. Agricultural development may create nodes of risk through the commercialization of agriculture if people, and again particularly women, have to stay overnight at evening markets. We know that AIDS is a domestic hazard, the intra-household clustering of infection. But also, if a family can only manage to wash clothes or only has a running stream in which to wash, children may be infected with a schistosome parasite, which in future life may render them more at risk of being infected with the virus. There is some evidence to show that. People who are food insecure or poor and marginalized are have less access to information and less ability to use it. And then finally, fundamentally, food insecurity does relate strongly to malnutrition. Malnutrition itself may, as we know, compromise immune function. There are links to increased risk of serious or more severe genital ulcers, which may be conduits for infection. We know about the ways in which women who are poor mothers give birth to low birth weight babies. Those low birth weight babies have particularly compromised immune system. Their gastrointestinal integrity is weaker. They're more likely to be infected with the virus in breastfeeding. There are particular interactions with various micronutrients. We still need to learn a lot more about them. Okay, the second part, the downstream, the ways in which AIDS is precipitating or exacerbating food and nutrition insecurity. Just to look at the issues with regard to agriculture, we know that agriculture is the number one major source of livelihood for most people on this planet living with HIV and AIDS. The types of indicators across the board, from subsistence, commercial, agricultural extension, relate to three types. Resource shortages and constraints. It's not just labor saving we need to be looking at. In many cases, it's cash saving. Cash might be the biggest constraint. Loss of knowledge, the fracture of intergenerational transfer of knowledge and skills from parents who are dying too young to pass them on to those skills to their children. And a breakdown and the fracture of institutional capacity and effects on organizational change. Looking at the impacts, again, going down into the micro of HIV and nutrition, I mentioned this term earlier. HIV raises energy requirements by 10 to 30% among adults, That's well documented by WHO, and 50 to 100% among children, growing children, who may be losing weight. Again, it's associated with immune decline. Low BMI, body mass index, hastens the severity of opportunistic infections, diarrhea, TB, which in turn will hasten death. BMI is as good in many ways an indicator of survival chances as CD4. At a population level, we're finding that kids in high HIV areas are particularly impacted, and there's a convergence of what used to be a difference between urban and rural areas because of HIV. There are many indirect effects on children whose caregiving is compromised due to the extra stress, again, particularly on women, as a result of HIV. And maternal orphans, we do have some good, strong evidence in many places that they are a particular risk, especially when young. Okay, last couple of slides. What do we do about this? And we're going to talk more with the other presentations on in terms of specific examples of what to do. But because much of this is situation-specific, we need to think in terms of tools, processes, principles to turn this evidence into action. We've used within Renewal this notion of a bifocal lens. It's a metaphor, but we also turn it into a practical tool as a checklist of questions to apply, both on a risk side, when we're looking, let's say, at an agricultural policy. There are various questions we apply to that policy, working with policymakers, to try and turn situations of risk into situations of resistance. Likewise, on the downstream, how to turn vulnerability into resilience. So just to conclude, again, I'm not obviously going to go into detail, but critically, the next step is how do we respond? The Durban Conference of last year really came down with these four categories of action. Firstly, and to be done simultaneously, these aren't either or phase. Firstly, strengthen household community resistance, avoidance of the virus, strengthen resilience to AIDS. Preserve and enhance and open up new livelihood options, community mobilization, protect vulnerable groups. Social protection has to go a long way beyond purely an economic safety net. And again, the particular concern with women and children directly affected by HIV/AIDS. And overriding and underpinning all this, there's a fundamental need to strengthen governance and strengthen capacity at all levels. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you for being so self-disciplined around the timing. I'm now going to call on Robin Jackson, who is chief of the HIV/AIDS service at the United Nations World Food Program. I'm a WFP groupie. So I'm particularly glad to have Robin take the platform now. We shared a platform yesterday morning where she released for the first time some absolutely fascinating financial data on the cost internationally of providing nutritious food supplement for those who were on ARVs. And it's a pleasure to bring Robin to the platform. She has written extensively on food security issues. Robin.
Thank you very much. My presentation is divided into three sections and is basically an illustration of much of the information that Stuart just shared with you. First, I want to discuss a little bit some methodological issues in carrying out vulnerability assessments. Then I'll present some results from two different assessments in East and Southern Africa, and I'll end with a few conclusions on these studies. There are a few challenges that we face when we do surveys to understand the dynamics between food security and AIDS. Many people in poor countries do not know their HIV status. This means relying heavily on proxies, such as the presence of chronic illness at the household level. Chronic illness has proven to be a relatively robust proxy for AIDS-affected households in a number of studies, as I'll show. Even with proxies, in settings with prevalence rates of, say, less than 10%, it can be difficult to get a big enough sample size to make a definitive conclusion about what's actually happening to affected households. Thirdly, many of the links between HIV and food security are temporal, so it can be difficult using cross-sectional surveys to capture processes that are happening over time, such as households gradually selling off assets to pay for healthcare. It's also difficult to measure things like food consumption of an individual using these survey techniques, biases can arise for a number of reasons. The first study I'd like to take you through is the Community Household Surveillance, a joint food and livelihood security monitoring system undertaken by WFP and CSAFE in 6 countries in the Southern Africa region shown on this map. CSAFE is the Consortium for Southern Africa Food Security Emergency and is comprised of a number of NGOs, including World Vision, Catholic Relief Services, and CARE International. CHS is a cross-sectional survey undertaken every 6 months, one in post-harvest season and one in the lean season. In this presentation, I refer to the first 4 rounds of data collection, beginning in September 2003 and ending in March 2005. I won't go into the methodological issues here, but the key things to remember are that as a cross-sectional survey, in each round, we have different households, but the survey is undertaken in the same geographical area. The other is that the survey is set up to compare households who benefit from food assistance with those who do not. When we disaggregate this data to compare families with chronically ill household members with those without chronic illness, we found a consistent pattern of those households being worse off. The coping strategy index score of such households is higher, as shown on this graph, because they engage in coping mechanisms that are more severe in order to meet their food needs. This suggests that the presence of a chronically ill household member in a household may be a useful targeting mechanism for direct transfers, such as food assistance, in times of crisis. We also found that households with chronically ill members were more likely to borrow money than those without illness in the family. When we asked them what they did with their loans, the majority said they used it to buy food. Healthcare and education were next on the list. The point here is that the loan burden over time may have a significant impact on a household's ability to recover after a food crisis. This is especially true for households with chronic illness, since they're more likely to lose a productive member whose labor would normally help in repaying the debt. It also means that short-term food assistance at this time could help them avoid going into debt, since most of the loans go towards buying food. Here we have compared the coping strategy index between households who received food assistance and those who did not. What we see here is that households who received food appeared consistently better off than those who didn't from rounds 2 through 4. While there is an increase in the coping strategy index for both groups in round 4, it appears less steep for those households who received food. Thus, food assistance is most likely helping households from having to engage in some of the more severe coping strategies, especially during crises. The second assessment I'll speak about comes from a survey that WFP did in East Africa in March of this year. This study uses slightly different parameters compared to the first one. In order to study the link between HIV and food insecurity, we divided the sample into affected and non-affected households. In this case, we defined affected households as those with a chronically ill member or those where death occurred in the previous 6 months. We also divided households up by gender and by gender of household head and by presence of orphans. These results support what we found in the CHS data. Affected households are significantly more food insecure than other households. In fact, over 2/3 of affected households are represented in the food insecure category, while only about half of the non-affected were in the same category. This graph shows that affected households are differently distributed among food security classes according to whether the household head is a female or a male. When the affected household is female-headed, the percentage of those food insecure increases to 71%. This data not only confirms what Stuart was just talking about, but also it confirms the notion that female-headed households are more food insecure, particularly when they have chronic illness or death in the family, and should be targeted for food assistance in times of stress. As these households are the most vulnerable to food insecurity, they should also be targeted for longer-term livelihood support. The assessment also found that twice as many affected households sold assets. Importantly, two-thirds of affected households sold productive assets, making recovery of those households much more difficult in the longer term. Again, these kinds of results point to the fact that these families should be targeted for assistance to help them meet both their long and short-term food needs. As has been said in other sessions at this conference, evidence about orphans and household food security is mixed. There's not a lot of data on this topic, and findings aren't always consistent. In this case, what we found was that in the poorest quintile, households with three or more orphans are really struggling to meet their food needs. When looking at the richest quintile, however, there was a consistent downward trend where the number of orphans in the household appears to be directly correlated with better consumption. At first glance, this is puzzling, but one of the possible explanations is that wealthier households who have the capacity to absorb orphans are doing so. Orphans live in families, and we need to understand the characteristics of those families to see whether these children are vulnerable to food insecurity. Thus, when analyzing data on orphans, it's important to try and disaggregate by socioeconomic status to understand what's happening. In summary, there are a few conclusions that can be made from the data that I've just presented. First of all, there are good proxy indicators we can use to understand the linkages between food insecurity and HIV. These include presence of chronic illness in the household, gender of the household head, number of orphans combined with wealth categories. Secondly, the data from Southern Africa indicates that food assistance can make a difference for vulnerable households in times of stress. This is particularly true for households with chronic illness. Thirdly, certain types of households, such as poor households hosting three or more orphans, or female-headed households with a chronic ill member, seem to be more vulnerable to food insecurity than others. These households need to be targeted for an array of assistance and services to support their livelihoods and make sure that both their long and short-term food needs are met. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Robin. That was an extraordinary slide on food insecurity and gender. I'd like now to move to Gabrielle Rugalema, who is the Senior Officer on HIV, AIDS, and Food Security at FAO. Gabrielle, because of the remarkable generosity of the World Food Program, you can have 11 minutes. And I turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I thought World Food Program provides food. They also provide time. That's very good. They are our partners, so we work together all the time, and I'm thankful to be part of what they do and them being part of what we do. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm height challenged, but I hope you will see me. When I saw this podium, I said, oh my God, I won't be seen by the audience. Good. We have heard of the impact of HIV/AIDS and what it's doing to agriculture, food security, and nutrition. And I want in the next 10 minutes to take you quickly on what we have been doing at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, FAO, to try and respond to these challenges. What is happening now? Yeah, I have the clicker, but the thing is dancing. Fine. So one body is evidence, which has already been ably presented by my colleagues, Stuart and Robin. And here I look at the implications. At FAO, we agree that there is an urgent need to meet immediate food and nutritional needs of populations, but also building their capacity for a long-term self-reliant future. So what we have been doing is based on a thorough analysis of the impact. It's based on targeting on both the susceptibility and vulnerability, But we have also been very careful to look at the gender and the age dimensions of the impact of the epidemic. And we have also looked then at multi-level, arguing that we have to build the capacity of communities, but also the capacity of government. If we don't bring this agenda to the agenda of the government, maybe we can't achieve much. So this slide shows some kind of conceptual map in which FAO designs its activities, capacity building at national level, capacity building at local level, nutritional support for people living with HIV/AIDS, but access to farm technologies and innovations, and then all these to try and empower vulnerable communities that are infected and affected by HIV/AIDS. At this point, I want to present but three of the activities that we have been doing. I don't know how I'm doing time-wise, but I'm sure I will finish. One of the activities we have been doing is on skills building, and this is called the Junior Farmer Field and Life School Program. What is this all about? This is, here I am. I think this is a response to increased vulnerability of young people, particularly those made vulnerable and orphaned by AIDS. Here we address the skills and knowledge gaps created by the premature death of parents. We try to provide safe space for these children to play, to associate, to learn. In short, we try to extend the envelope of socialization and reintegration into schools and society. And we have this program running in about 7 countries in Africa now, in Southern Africa. But what lessons are we learning from this activity? Is that nutritional support is critical, and this is where WFP has been really very useful. These kids come to us when they are malnourished, and you don't expect them to learn and even play if they are hungry. So food supply and food provision is one central activity. But we have seen that you need to tap into community, to mobilize community, so that these junior farmer field and life schools become a community project. You can't do it outside the community. You can't do it outside the government. I think when you do, you work with kids, you need also to have safeguards to ensure kids are not exploited or abused. It can easily happen. And we are noting that this program is helping to reintegrate the children who have dropped out of school back into school, because these programs are done in close collaboration with the schools. There is issue of cost. We can demonstrate that is cost effective, and it can easily be integrated into existing vocational education programs. In fact, one country, Mozambique, they have managed to scale it up to, I think, around 30 schools now. And they want to take it over to become one of the country's vocational educational programs for orphaned kids and kids in difficult circumstances. So, further lessons, I think. Agricultural knowledge, as I said, and the skills are being acquired, and that's apart from teaching agricultural and entrepreneurial skills, life skills are necessary to improve their self-esteem and build the confidence among these children. And that, we are finding that this program has provided entry points for education on gender, AIDS, and other social issues that can lead to social change. So the other program that I quickly want to tell you about is the program on property and inheritance rights, particularly for widows and children. Here we are talking about poverty, but this poverty can't be tackled if we don't address the issue of property rights, because property rights is central to poverty, is central to vulnerability, particularly for women who lose husbands. So we have conducted quite a number of research studies in different regions, and it shows that property grabbing is widespread, and that loss of property leads to vulnerability. So what we have been doing is to try and provide technical assistance in policy formulation, in the property protection of property rights of widows, including some formulation of bills. We are working with the Malawi government together with UNFPA on this one. We have also been doing paralegal training for NGOs that provide legal support to women, legal support and such information. The third activity and the last one I want to tell you about is strengthening institutional capacity, particularly government capacity. We have mainly been working with governments in training of researchers in agricultural institutes and in related institutions to analyze the impact of AIDS on production systems and livelihood. But we are also providing technical support in formulation of agriculture and natural resources strategies on HIV and AIDS and working with different governments from Tanzania to Zimbabwe and others. This slide shows the first class of, 2003 of the junior farmer field and life schools in Mozambique. See how happy and proud they are. Their farm has been able to produce these products. And we hope that such training is really central to the millions of orphans who have been orphaned by HIV/AIDS, not only for the skills, but also for reintegration and self-esteem and for the future. Ladies and gentlemen, the motto of this conference is time to deliver. I want to end by saying it is time to deliver on responses to HIV/AIDS, nutrition, and food security. If we don't, we are damned. We need to invest in this area. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gabrielle. I might share with the audience, this is a complete coincidence, that just a couple of weeks ago when I was in Mozambique, I visited a junior farmer field and life schools project, and it was astonishingly impressive, and it did invest a great deal of self-confidence and hope in the young people who were involved. We now move to Kenya and lessons from the field, a woman's perspective. And we have as the presenter Leonido Akei, who is the founder of GROOTS, the grassroots organizations operating together in sisterhood. It's nice to have sisterhood present at this gathering. Come forward, Leonida.
Thank you, Chairman. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here for us to listen to what we are going to say. I come from Western Kenya, Siaya District. My organization, as you have heard, is called Siaya Groots. The word Groots stands for grassroots organizations operating together in sisterhood. It is a community-based organization made up of 17 women from 40 years onwards. And we only have one youth who is a girl. We have been working together since 1995, and all of us are on voluntary basis, and sometimes through partnerships with other organizations, notably CARE. Siaya is poor and rural. Most people rely on agriculture. They grow their own food to earn extra money. The estimated population is 438,000, and this is according to the Bureau of Statistics. And that number has grown. In our tradition, land is parcelled to sons and not daughters, and the amount each family has to grow food has become smaller and smaller over the years. Over half of households are food insecure. The HIV prevalence rate is 24%, which is more than three times the national rate in Kenya. There are many orphans. The National AIDS Control Council estimates that almost 50,000 children in Siaya have lost one or both parents due to AIDS. They are so many that most people are caring for extra children, and some children are left without carers. The result is child-headed households. Stigma and discrimination are rife. Now, when our organization Groots began doing home visitations in 1995, no one knew what to do with HIV/AIDS patients. They didn't know how to handle them. They just didn't know which way to go. They just left them alone. When a woman is infected with HIV, in most cases, the husband and the relatives look at her as the one who has brought the disease into the family. So in most cases, they don't accept her. Instead of accommodating her in the home, in some cases, they chase them away back to their mothers. And you can imagine the kind of burden the mothers have, looking after the orphans from the sons, looking after the orphans from the daughters, and again looking after the daughters who can barely manage. Now, traditionally, when a woman loses the husband, in some cases the in-laws take her land and property away, because in our tradition, land does not belong to women. And I guess this is so in many other places in the world. Women use land, but they don't own it. So she does, though, get to keep her children, which is also a burden to her. So these women who are already very poor are made poorer and have the extra burden of supporting their children on their own. Now, Groots has made a difference. We work with OVCs. We motivated the community members to donate and cook food at lunch in schools. About 2,000 OVCs who have lost both parents get lunch, and most are girls. We help the children to grow kitchen gardens in their homes and teach them agricultural skills. Some have been able to go for vocational training through support from other organizations. With the training and support from CARE, we have set up 80 savings and loans groups for very poor women, mostly widows. They form groups of 5 to 15 members and agree to save an amount of money each month. In each meeting, they agree on how much to lend and how many people will get loans and the amount of interest they want to charge. When the money is returned, the interest is saved and loaned out again with a monthly contribution. We also help women set up income-generating activities like tea kiosks, fishmongering, vegetable growing, among others, and the women now feel richer and empowered. Because property rights are such a big thing or a big problem, we decided to do something about it. First, we approached the chiefs and talked to them about women's problems regarding property. Now they understand, and in most cases, they intervene when in-laws try to take away property. We have also formed partnerships with paralegals for the times when it does not work to speak with the chief. We have also set up round tables with all the 80 savings and loans groups where we work. We sit down with them and the local leaders, that is chiefs, religious leaders, and custodians of culture, and discuss matters affecting women. For example, The old practice where a brother takes care of his dead husband's children and protects the wife. This is what is supposed to happen, but sometimes the brother sees wife inheritance as a way to exploit the wife. So he will take away the property in some cases, but not only that, he will also demand special care. Good food, you know, maybe hot water for bathing and things like that, which is too much for the lady who is already widowed and has children to look after. This is what is supposed to happen, but sometimes the brother sees wife inheritance as a way to exploit the wife. Property has made this worse. In the old days, there was no property. So we try to take them back to the spirit of our traditions and at the same time to empower women to understand their rights and that no one has permission to exploit them. We are happy that now the chiefs, the local administration is cooperating. These are only part of our program. We also provide home-based care, not just nursing, but also cleaning, fetching water, cooking, psychosocial care and support, and have set up post-test clubs. Now, what are the lessons learned? When we help vulnerable people, whether they are OVCs or widows, become more financially secure and able to grow their own food, their level of dependency on other community members is reduced. This helps them to regain their dignity. And in the case of people living with HIV and AIDS, it also helps to reduce stigma. Now, since we started working with CARE on Kungo Kod Hola, it's popularly known back home as KKH, and it's very popular and successful with women. Now, when we started working with CARE on this program, we have noticed that the people have become more friendlier. They seek one another, they share ideas, they laugh together, they sing together. Now they are all one large family. They share ideas, and it is a happy community. Thank you.
Well, let me reinforce your thank you of Leonida. It's really moving and important to hear what these extraordinary grassroots organizations do. A small NGO, a community-based NGO dealing with orphans and property and home-based care and food and integrating them all together so that you induce an atmosphere of hope and a diminution of stigma and a feeling of happiness in the community. It's amazing to see. I know there are many, many people in this room who are witness to it. We go to our last speaker, who is Sipiwe Plofus. This is easy for me because Sipiwe, I value as one of my closest friends in this odd life in the world of HIV and AIDS. Sipiwe heads SWAPL, Swazi Positive Living, people living with AIDS, women living with AIDS in Swaziland. It is in Swaziland one of the most notable and formidable organizations, and I'm delighted to invite Sipiwe to take the microphone.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Stephen Lewis. I'm Sipiwe Hlophe from Swaziland Positive Living, a woman living with HIV and AIDS. I'm Sipiwe Hlophe from Swaziland, from an organization of women living with HIV and AIDS. We call our organization SWAPL. I'll just give you a brief background. SWAPL was formed in 2001 We were five women who had experience of stigma and victimization by our in-laws and the community at large. From 2001, we are now 1,250 women living with HIV and AIDS in 30 communities. Our main goal is to provide the quality of life for people living with HIV and AIDS, affected families, and our orphans and vulnerable children. But here, I would be giving you the field experience. What are we doing at the field level? And then I've just taken the two objectives under food security, because we have so many co-business in our organization. One of our objectives is to ensure food availability at household level. And then the other one is to promote the status of people living with HIV and AIDS. We want to empower them on economic and livelihood projects. And then let me skip the core business. And then why food security to us living with HIV and AIDS? As our first speaker has mentioned, that it is very important that we get food nutrition. We have to have food security at household level. As a person living with HIV and AIDS, you need food supplement to this weakened of our immune system. What is it that we are doing as SWAPOL under food security? We are having various activities that we are doing at a community level. One, we are producing food. And then our first activity is the crop production. We have secured 11 hectares of land where we are growing varieties of crops, groundnuts, beans, maize, and chico beans. This is part of our nutritious food in Swaziland. If you look at the variety of these crops, we have nutrition and starch that is needed by our body. And then we are also growing vegetable. What we have done so far, we've initiated a support of people living with HIV and AIDS to grow vegetable at community level. As you are seeing this woman in her vegetable garden, she's trying to weed. And then this, what is it that we are doing with our vegetable? We use our vegetable for food consumption, and we also sell our vegetables to earn up a living. And then another activity, we are promoting backyard gardens. As I have said before, that we are also promoting the livelihood and the nutrition at our orphans and vulnerable children. Here, we are promoting backyard gardens for child-headed household. You are now seeing the children that are weeding in their backyard garden. Sometimes here you call them kitchen garden. It's just a small garden that can be managed by children. And we have a livelihood project, the seedling production. The project is focusing on the seedling production for planting. From this garden, from this project, we usually take our seedling, we distribute them to people living with HIV and AIDS for promotion of food security and good nutrition, and for promotion of establishing their own backyard garden. We also sell the seedlings to our local farmers to earn up a small living. And then the food that we have produced from our farm and the vegetables that we have produced from our garden, we are feeding our orphans. There is a center that is called the Neighborhood Care Point, where orphans are getting meals per day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Before I go to challenges, I would just want to give you the lesson that we have learned so far. One, we are saying, as people living with HIV and AIDS, if you had adequate resources automatically that can empower people living with HIV and AIDS at a community level. And then good nutrition can also prolong our life because they substitute our immune system. And then people living with HIV and AIDS can maintain their project if they are well capacitated, as we have seen on our slides. And then OVC heading household can be provided with food if you make sure that you empower the young ones on parenting skills, and then they can keep their, they can be happy, and then they can have food at a household level. Challenges that we are facing so far. One is the inadequate funding for food security. Most of the donor, what we've realized as an organization, they want to give handout, whereas we want to be empowered to grow our food so that we can get fresh food from the garden. And then the other challenge that we have, there is more demand for food security to our support groups of people living with HIV and AIDS. That is a great demand. In Swaziland, we don't have big industries. We are only on the agricultural-based country where we can grow a lot of food. In my conclusion, Chairperson, I would say behind a successful program, there is a woman. Thank you.
Sapiwe will be embarrassed by this, but let me inform all of you that last Monday night at an extraordinarily moving gathering of African women from this conference, many of them leaders, a combination of ActionAid and the African Women's Development Fund and the Open Society Institute Fund for Women and Dealing with AIDS, they got together and they created the first inaugural Fighting Spirit Award, and they conferred it upon Sapiwe. We're now ready to enter the question and answer period. There are microphones, microphone 3, 2, and 1. And I'll take them in order as I see them. May I ask those who come to the microphone to identify themselves and to ask a question with brevity, or if you're making a comment, exercise even greater brevity. Let me move first to microphone 3.
Thank you. First of all, may I bestow my congratulations on all of you for the incredible work that you're doing in reaching out to these vulnerable populations. I really appreciate it. Now to my question. I was just wondering, many of you have spoken about networks and areas in which you are reaching out to orphans in particular, and I was wondering if any of the areas at which you're providing them with education and opportunities to network with other youth, if you were offering them also an opportunity to receive sexual education, and if you were, what sort of education you were providing to them?
Leonida or Sapiwe, do you want to... you both mentioned orphans extensively in your remarks.
Thank you, Chair. We are involved with our orphans, but we don't provide sexual education. That is still debated in the Ministry of Education, whether it should be included in the curriculum or not. But the sources are it's a society that has that identify themselves as people with their custom and the cultural practice, that doesn't allow sexual education at school. But what we have done so far with our orphans at the neighborhood care point, we have managed to mobilize funding for them to go to school. We are supported by one of the charity organizations in UK, and that is a great achievement for us. Where we are, there is not even one orphan who is not at school. Thank you.
Let me go to microphone two.
Yes, my name is Barbara Brilliant. I'm from Liberia. I've been working there for 30 years. I'm with the Catholic Church. We've been working with HIV/AIDS since 2001. As you know, we're just coming out of war. We have 85% unemployment, but my question goes to Robin. The WFP could do more, I think. Right now, we have people living with HIV/AIDS who are kept on single rations. And I think women who have been put out of the household, who have 3, 4, 5 dependents, need family hold rations.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in terms of what I would say, WFP policy is to talk about, instead of just feeding the patient, also to be making sure that families have enough to eat. One thing I think that everybody in this room needs to understand, WFP is a voluntarily funded organization. We depend on donors. If we're cutting back rations, it's because donors are not funding these kinds of programs. We look to you to advocate on behalf of all of those people, for example, in Liberia and elsewhere, who are on treatment, who are in home-based cares, et cetera, who do not have enough to eat. Thank you.
Microphone one.
Thank you. Mine are just comments. I'm called Nick Chambali from the Organization of African Institute Churches in Nairobi. These are comments. Policy has just been mentioned. One thing that hasn't been mentioned is trade, the waste and the trade and food security. We are being treated as objects of mercy. When you take away what is ours, we are taking a cup of coffee at $1. 2 kilos of coffee in Africa can't give you $1. That must be dealt with. Our colleagues from the West, stop that. Two, World Bank should have been here for us to face them. We are not seeing them. Agricultural extension services have been privatized. How will people living with HIV start paying for agriculture extension services? Yes, CBOs are doing a good job, NGOs are doing a good job, but people's rights have been taken away. Extension services are social services, but now they are commercial services with the support of World Bank, and many countries, including Uganda, have taken off in that direction. We must stop that. That is one thing. And finally, I would like to say, our colleagues in the North, in this meeting, you are looking at us in Africa as people who need you. Please, we are partners. We need behavioral change in the North when it comes to trade and agriculture. It will liberate the women.
Strikes me that there's a greater possibility of sexual behavior change in response to the pandemic than there is the possibility of behavior change in the Western world in response to trade. Microphone three.
Thank you. My name is Carrie Osborne. I work for Save the Children. I'm also a director of Funway Farm Limited, a social investment farm in a poor and remote area of Malawi. The land is farmed by small farmers growing maize, sorghum, beans and vegetables for seed, which is sold to other farmers to grow food. A problem that we face is the inconsistency of government policy year on year affecting our ability to plan what we grow. Some years the government buys the seed for targeted inputs, which is great. Some years seed is imported or donated by foreign governments, hence affecting the marketing of the seed. A farm tries to plan what it grows on a 3-year rotation cycle. If a government does not have a long-term policy, we can be wrong every year. Farmers risk growing the wrong crop and hence earn nothing. How can we and FAO work with governments and agricultural ministries and donors to create stable policies to enable farmers to plan, to enable them to reduce food insecurity and vulnerability?
Thank you. That was a question combined with a comment. I'm going to turn it to our colleague from FAO.
Hello. I think that's a very valid question, and I think it's a part of our quest to try and put AIDS on the government agenda. Not only in Malawi, but I think in many other places, existing agricultural policy doesn't always work to the advantage of vulnerable people and particularly communities affected by HIV/AIDS. I think specifically for Malawi, one opportunity is that the Ministry of Agriculture has just released its policy on HIV/AIDS. And it talks about some fairness and equality in agriculture trade and how to meet the needs of vulnerable people. But I think one of the good opening that there is that the government has asked the ministries of natural resources and ministries of agriculture to come with one sectoral strategy. And that sectoral strategy is being formulated now with the support of FAO. And I think that such feelings are part of what we ought to put in there. I think if you contact FAO in Malawi and they continue to contact me, that's one thing that I will make sure that we put it on the in the policy and see how we can support that.
Thank you, Gabrielle. I suggest you make direct contact with Gabrielle before we leave the room. Microphone 2.
Yes. I'm called Ruben Mubiru from Chetume Community Based Health Care Program in Uganda. First of all, let me thank all the foundations, the Stephen Lewis Foundation, Fairlight Foundation, who have enabled many CBOs of which fall into my category to participate in this world event. Thank you very much. My first question is, you've talked about food security, but I've not heard anything regarding the food supplements which could be given to children who are under the PMTCT service. If we are to prevent mother-to-child, we need to talk about the supplementary feeding of the children under this conference. I don't know what you can do about it as World Food Program. Second point is that World Food Program actually gives out a hand to people to get relief in some areas, in some parts of my country and other parts of Africa. But while they are withdrawing, they don't have any sustainable kind of approach of how people can continue to sustain themselves after receiving that relief. So I would wish to know your criteria. I would wish to know your strategy while we are withdrawing, when you are giving out relief to people. How should they really sustain them? And remember, their health is just diminishing and they cannot produce food. So I want that area to be addressed. Then lastly...
No, you've already had the last...
Thank you very much. May God bless.
Thanks. The two questions, PMTCT and the second question on withdrawing the food.
Okay, fine. Concerning PMTCT and food supplements for children, I mean, I think that this is one thing that in this conference there was exactly one session on this topic. It's been completely missing from the entire 5 days of events, and it's something that we absolutely need to look into. In terms of WFP and our policy, we stick with the UNICEF and WHO guidelines right now on exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months. There is a lot of data out there which strongly suggests that this is much less dangerous than actually providing mothers with any kind of substitute milk or formula. In terms of relief, and I think that what you're talking about is transitioning to sustainable livelihoods, this is something that we are extremely concerned about, and we're also looking for other partners. WFP does not operate all by itself. It operates within a community of service providers, humanitarian workers, local NGOs, etc. What we need to do is to make sure that the kinds of relief assistance that we're giving dovetails into what we would consider to be more sustainable livelihood support. This is exactly the kind of program that we're doing with FAO, with the Junior Farmer Field and Life Schools. Gabriel?
Yeah, just to echo quickly what my colleague Robin has just said. I attended that session, I think 2 days ago, in which we talked about ready-to-use therapy. What FAO has been doing in Malawi, working with the Nutrition Rehabilitation Units, is to try and give this ready-to-use therapy to children. They are admitted for about 30 to 90 days. But one of the things that convinces me that we need to move to dovetail this with sustainable food security is that 25 to 50% of the kids are readmitted within 3 to 6 months, which tells me, you admit them, you give them nutrition, they go home, they starve, they come back. We need to break that cycle.
Thank you. Microphone one.
Thank you. My name is Boga Fitzani. I'm from Botswana. I work for NACA. My question goes to Gabriel. Why have you restricted your useful projects to the 7 countries in Southern Africa when it is clear that they are so useful and could be useful to the rest of the region if indeed it is time to deliver? Thank you.
A very difficult question, but let me say one thing, that those who work in this field, especially at the very beginning, it was very difficult to explain to the skeptics that nutrition and food security is important for HIV/AIDS, even today. So what was the consequence is that we don't have enough resources to roll out the program where we would like. And that's why such a session like this one should really play the role of advocacy and trying to bring in more funds so that these useful programs are not confined to small villages in tiny countries in the middle of nowhere, but they are rolled out to help many people, many needy people as possible. So I think it has been a question of resources, and this question of resources really needs to be resolved.
Thank you, Gabrielle. Microphone 3.
Good morning. My name is Zoe Dean-Smith. I'm a Swazi, born in Swaziland, living in Swaziland, and working with 700 rural Swazi women who make handcrafted and tableware products, which we export to 32 countries around the world. Up until this morning, I had never even heard of SWAPO, which I find amazing because we have such a small country. So I'd like to say first, I'd like to congratulate you on what you're doing. We have just recently registered a non-profit company so that we can address the same issues for our rural women. So at the end of this session, I would like to get your details so that we can work together and help each other, because I love what you're doing and we can make a big difference together in Swaziland. That's my first comment. My second is just to say, in response to a comment earlier, that we have been working with the World Bank's International Finance Corporation for the last 2 years, and they have given us invaluable technical and financial assistance in ensuring the sustainability of our business. Thank you.
You know, it doesn't surprise me. Microphone 2.
My name is Fiona Perry. I work as the HIV coordinator for Tearfund's disaster management team. We're currently operational in 9 countries. My question is for Stuart. You talked about the relationship between HIV, food security, and gender. I wondered if you considered conflict and post-conflict issues within this context. I think this is very important in countries of low prevalence, like Southern Sudan, who are in a post-conflict situation. And they may not see HIV as a top priority, but they have all the signs of vulnerability towards HIV.
Thank you very much. Absolutely, I think it's extremely important and it's extremely neglected. There is actually just, well, we have a study in the Renewal Network currently in the field in northern Uganda that looks at gender-based violence and the interaction with food security and risk of HIV and AIDS. That is one, but there are several others, but not enough. Also, with regard to the interaction, with regard to conflict and refugees and nutrition and food security, just to note, there has just been published a useful best practice paper by UNAIDS on that issue, but I think it's an important issue, but it is neglected.
It's an excellent question, and if I may say, in all of the countries coming out of conflict, whether it's Sudan or Angola, where the prevalence rates are either very low or as yet unauthenticated, there is great concern, there's enormous concern in those countries about what's going to happen and how to contain it. Can we go to microphone one?
Thank you very much. And thank you to all of the panelists, and thank you to all of my colleagues here today as well for all of your very truly excellent work in this area. My name is Katie Greenwood, and I'm from Partners in Health. We're a health and human rights organization working in Haiti, Peru, Russia, Rwanda, Lesotho, and Boston. And I first actually wanted to make a quick comment about breastfeeding and mother-to-child transmission. For those of you who are interested in seeing some very convincing data around the the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, I encourage you to stop by the Partners in Health booth and pick up a copy of our poster on our project in Haiti, providing formula supplements in an extremely resource-poor setting and the excellent results we've had with that program. My question is related to a topic we haven't actually addressed here, which is the fact that a lot of agriculture in Africa is treated as a mining operation, where the sensitive soils and minerals of Africa, those that are relatively good, are devoted to cash crop production and exported to the rest of the world at extremely low cost. At the same time, very low nutritive varieties of maize and other exotic crops are extensively promoted by international financial institutions and by proxy by ministries of agriculture in many southern African countries. And my question is, as a health and medical community, how can we better advocate for higher nutritive varieties of crops for use by subsistence farmers in Africa? And I'm not talking about the development of a new drought-tolerant, high nutritive value maize. We already have something like that in Africa, and it's called sorghum. So how can we better promote local crops and better support the need for getting rid of this extractive agriculture industry in Africa? Thank you.
Gabrielle, do you want to say something about that? Are you concerned about your relations with the international financial institutions? Would you like to respond?
No.
Go ahead, Stuart.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this applies even without HIV, this imbalance and this exploitation on a macro level, and how to generate incentives for that to happen. But what HIV is doing is showing, in many levels, HIV shows the fragility of systems, livelihood systems, in this case, the national level systems. So it's yet another, I don't have the answer, but I mean, it just throws the whole thing into relief.
Turn to microphone 3.
My name is Maria Tokwani. I come from Zimbabwe. I work for Care International in a food project as the HIV and AIDS specialist. I'm actually privileged to read around, and I also found this declaration, the UNIGAS declaration that was made in 2001, and the other one in 2006, that was a revision one, which says resolve to integrate food and nutritional support with the global with the goal that all people at all times will have access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food to meet their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life as part of the comprehensive response to HIV and AIDS. And I was also privileged to attend the Africa Forum 2006, where we were actually looking at HIV and AIDS and food insecurity as a dual epidemic. I remember for this forum, actually, a declaration actually came out. And these things or these policies or the declarations are there. But how then do we make them happen? How do we make them, possible, real to the communities where we are coming from? Thank you.
Anybody want to take a crack at answering that? How do you make this stuff real?
Yeah, maybe I offer a small comment. I think there is always some difference between rhetoric and the reality. And sometimes when we craft these resolutions, we really don't look at what it will take to implement and to monitor and to make sure that things are done. I mean, I think in terms of implementation, when we talk about food reaching everybody, do we have such infrastructure? Do we have the resources to ensure that this happens? How can we monitor the system and stuff like that? So I think it's a good intention, but it needs resources to accompany it and ensure that it becomes a reality. Otherwise, it remains rhetoric. It could as well have been nice for those leaders to stay home and do good things rather than declare to the world that they want to solve a problem which they are not solving.
Gabrielle, I think you're right, and I would respectfully suggest that at some point in time, United Nations organizations that are involved in this process should not find themselves trapped by the rhetorical fatuity of many of these resolutions and clauses. On June the 1st and 2nd last, the United Nations brought everyone together, as you'll know, for the declaration, the second declaration of commitment under UNGAS. And Article 28 read, and I quote, "All people at all times will have access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food to meet their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life as part of a comprehensive response to HIV and AIDS." All people at all times will have access. There's something deeply offensive about the entire world subscribing to that kind of proposition and then doing so little to achieve it. And it's important. And it's important, it seems to me, for United Nations agencies not to be complicit in the rhetorical hyperbole of governments. That's what the United Nations is there for. Let me move to microphone two.
Okay, my name's Edwina. I'm from VSO Mozambique. My first question is to Gabriel. The majority of farmers in Southern Africa are women. So I was wondering if you have ever thought of extending the junior farmer field schools to women so that they can also get life skills and agricultural skills. And my second question is that in Africa, most of the economy is dependent on agriculture. So what about mainstreaming HIV and AIDS in agriculture? Because the agricultural extension workers go to those places where the community needs to work. And we found that that's been very successful. So I was wondering if you would have thought of doing that, maybe even with the Ministry of Agriculture.
Gabrielle?
Yeah. Good. Maybe a small background that farmer field schools is an offshoot of what started as an IPM, Integrated Pest Management in Asia, and it has been extended to Africa. And so, yes, pharma-field schools for women, for men, are part of the FAO food security programs. And there must be pharma-field schools in the countries you come from, because they are, as I said, part of the comprehensive program on food security. I don't have particular examples and in which countries, how many pharma groups are there, but I think they are part of our sort of extension approach, and they have been promoted in most African countries. Regarding to working with the ministries, we have been working with the different ministries of agriculture and natural resources on integrating HIV/AIDS. I can cite specifically Malawi, Zambia, Tanzania, currently Zimbabwe, and Namibia.
Robin, did you want to add something?
No, I just, on behalf of FAO, to talk about their programs for them, just wanted to say that, in fact, in the IPM, the Integrated Pest Management, they do have components on prevention education and prevention awareness for HIV, and it's been a hugely successful way to get this kind of information to men as opposed to only targeting women.
Thank you. Microphone one.
Thank you. My name is Lee Hensinger, and I'm from McMaster University here in Ontario. And my question is actually with regards to global warming and food security. I think we can all agree that global warming is not something made up anymore, that there is really good evidence that summarized nicely by Al Gore's recent film, The Inconvenient Truth. But I'm wondering what kind of discussion is going on about global warming and food security in Africa, as we can now recognize that it's not just ice melting north of the 60th parallel, but that it's going to be a global problem, and already probably is. Thank you.
I think it's a good question, but I think it's venturing slightly far afield, and I'd like to keep this, if I may, in the few minutes that are left, to the question of gender and nutrition and food security and AIDS. Microphone three.
Thank you. My name is Rachel Besner-Kerr, and I'm at the University of Western Ontario, and I'm working with an agriculture and nutrition project based at Ekwendeni Hospital in Malawi. So I have two brief questions. The first is to Robin, and it's actually a somewhat technical question with regards to your definition of HIV-affected families. Given the important role that grandmothers play, and that's been highlighted in various parts of the conference, where do grandmothers who've taken in orphans fit into the picture of HIV-affected households? Because it seemed, according to your definition, that they might be missed in that statistic. So I was interested in your response to that. And I wanted to direct my second question to Sipiwe. Ekwendeni Hospital has also been involved in trying to produce food that they then distribute to orphans and vulnerable children. And I was interested in your neighborhood care points. Given that people living with AIDS face labor issues in producing food for themselves, is the wider community involved in also producing that food for neighborhood care points? And have you had difficulty, if so, in garnering the interest of the local community and in helping to produce food for those orphans and vulnerable children? Thank you.
Thank you. Those are awfully good questions. Thank you for asking them. First, Robin.
The grandmothers that you were talking about are most likely in that 71% of female-headed households, which are in the poorest and most food insecure category. That's where they're captured. The other place that they will probably be captured as well has to do with the number of orphans over three and in the poorest categories. So, yes, I think they are an important group. And in terms of our kinds of data, I think that we can capture this. Thank you.
Thank you. Sipiwe?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Can you move the microphone a little closer to you? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, what I would say on the, I would divide the question into two parts. One on the labor that is provided by people living with HIV and AIDS. When you are HIV positive, it doesn't mean that you are weak, you cannot work. So when you are AIDS blown out, it's where you cannot go to the garden and do the work. But right now, We are fit. We can produce the food at a field level. So labor, it's not a problem. And then the second part, we have already mobilized the community to assist in the labor. If ever there is a problem, we can request the community or the guardians of the orphans to come and support us in our field. That has been shown as a positive support from the community.
Thank you. The neighborhood care points in Swaziland are really fascinating. It's a sort of mutual activity of WFP, UNICEF, and SWAPOL in community gardens and preparing food, nutritious food for children. And it does a quite unusual job of meeting some of the food needs for orphans and vulnerable kids. It has not been tried in other countries. It's an excellent innovation. Microphone two.
My name is Sean Dan Berletta. I'm from Ethiopia, working with FAO as a national consultant on health, nutrition, and HIV/AIDS. I don't have any specific question, but to complement with what my fellows from FAO and WFP said from the Ethiopian experience. In Ethiopia, we have been working on appreciating the linkage between HIV/AIDS and the agricultural sector and nutrition. From our brief observations that we made, we observed that the linkage is not well recognized even by policymakers and by implementing partners at lower level. And we are working more on trying to integrate HIV/AIDS into the agricultural sector. In addition to that, we have also identified that there is a knowledge gap. And for that purpose, we are trying to integrate HIV/AIDS into the curriculum of the agricultural training facilities and health training facilities. Thirdly, we have tried to develop a nutritional care and support manual for people living with HIV/AIDS, which is serving as a guideline for caregivers and for health workers and for the agricultural extension workers. What I would like to bring to the attention of my...
I'm going to have to interrupt you and say that whatever you have brought to the attention so far will have to suffice. Thank you very, very much, sir. And microphone one.
Thank you for this opportunity. First, I want to applaud the work that the women are doing. And I just wanted you to give me or to share your experience with me, probably just enlighten me on how you deal with the situation of child-headed homes. I don't know if you have so many such cases and how do they, because I know a lot of them probably lose their lands and, you know, all those other things. So how are they part of the program that you're running in terms of agriculture and providing food for them? Thank you.
May I suggest that Leonida and Sapiwe respond to that, and then I'm going to call the session to a close, because in truth the session is gradually emptying itself in any event. Go ahead, Leonida.
Thank you, Chairman. Now, the issue of child-headed homes is not a very easy thing to deal with. In the first place, they are too young to care for themselves, and they don't have enough resources to look after themselves. So in most cases, it is the community that try to assist them, get their level, get food, get direction on which way to go. But it is not a very easy thing. Thank you.
Sapiwe, do you want to say something about child-headed households?
Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, it is very hard to work with these children because sometimes we find that there is no food on the table, they don't have even clothing. But what we usually do, we give what we have, or we just go to our friends, the Stephen Lewis Foundation, not him, please. The foundation, we just request for some food supplements and so on, so some food portions, so that we can give it to them. Sometimes we mobilize the community to take care of them, to visit them and check how are they. But there is a problem that we've encountered so far, the problem of the young girls being abused by the relatives in order to put food on the table. That is now the problem we are facing so far.
Well, that's a difficult issue with which to end the discussion, but on your collective behalf, I want to thank this quite excellent panel, and I'd like to thank you. I'd like to thank all of you for engaging in an exchange which was productive rather than protracted. And I hope that the remaining sessions today and tomorrow, as the conference draws to a close, will engage your equal enthusiasm. Thank you immensely, everyone, for being here.